This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Our guest today is Dr. Zach Fry. Welcome, Dr. Fry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And today we're going to do a reassessment of a Civil War general that many people, frankly, will not have heard of. But the ones who have probably have a very curtailed view of him, I think that's fair to say, and that is General George Meade. So let me kind of try to summarize the book on Meade, and Dr. Fry, you can tell me how wrong I am about it. So I think it's fair to say the general perception of Meade, if people even know who he is... He kind of falls backwards into victory at Gettysburg, then is put in charge of the invasion of Virginia up to the next year. Grant gets frustrated with him and kind of comes down and takes over and then leads the army to win the war. Is that kind of a fair popular assessment of Meade?
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis of what a lot of folks might think about George Gordon Meade coming in. I think the only thing I would add is that some folks I have found actually are under the impression that Meade was fired after Gettysburg, that Meade essentially followed the same pattern of other Army of the Potomac commanders, who include George McClellan, where as soon as Lee's army is chased back to Virginia, Meade is then shelled and Grant is brought in.
Right.
That's the popular perception, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to mention so many people's view of the Civil War is Gettysburg the movie. And Meade is, in many ways, kind of an also-ran in that movie, so I think that probably doesn't help. He's not one of the featured characters.
He has about 30 seconds. There are really good 30 seconds, but he's got about 30 seconds in that film.
Right. Okay, so let's pick this apart. Let's talk about who this man was and what his actual legacy was. So who is George Meade? Where does he come from?
Well, Meade is a Philadelphian, first and foremost. He comes from an old Philadelphia family, even though he was born in Spain, in Cadiz, actually. About 6 months after Waterloo, he's born to a family that's living in Spain because his dad is a very wealthy Philadelphia merchant who's actually been bankrolling the Spanish government for a while during the Peninsula War.
And for background on this, there's a Republican movement that's centered in Cadiz, which is why that there's a government locus there.
Good. So Meade only spends a couple years of his life in Cadiz before he comes over as a toddler to the United States, grows up in Philadelphia, goes to some very good schools, and like some others of his day, including George McClellan, he will then go from these sort of Philadelphia prep schools into the United States Military Academy. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a middling cadet. He performs well academically, but not great in terms of discipline, so he graduates kind of in the middle of his class, and of course West Point classes back then were about 50 guys, so he graduates, I think, 19th out of about 50 in the class of 1835, goes into the regular army for his mandatory 1 year of service, and then does a brief stint in civilian life as a civil engineer before re-entering the United States Regular Army before the Mexican War. And he will actually serve in the Seminole War and in the Mexican War. Does fairly well in the Mexican War. Not necessarily.
Theater?
Actually, he was assigned for most of his experience, if I remember correctly, to Zachary Taylor's campaign up in the North. But I think he did serve briefly as a staff officer for Scott. I don't think that he met Lee during that time, but I could be mistaken. He is recalled back to Washington on official duties before the end of the war. Doesn't necessarily have the really dazzling Mexican War career that some of his contemporaries had. But he is nonetheless a very competent, a very successful staff officer. And like a lot of the good officers in the United States Regular Army before the Civil War, that means he is in the topographical engineers. Mm-hmm. And so for the 1850s, much of his experience as a topographical engineer is in the fascinating arena of building lighthouses on the Atlantic coast all the way down to the Keys. And that's pretty much Meade's pre-war experience.
What rank is he right at the outbreak of the war? Call it 1860. Is he a captain?
Yeah, okay. He's a captain. And at the outbreak of the war, he's actually attached to a survey team, or I think leading a survey team, of the Great Lakes. So he's in Detroit, Michigan. And when the war breaks out, he eventually will be given Brigadier Generalship of Volunteers as commander of a brigade of what are called the Pennsylvania Reserves. They were just the last few regiments that arrived in Harrisburg and the initial call for volunteers, so they got designated reserves.
So let's pick some of these details apart, because I think they're important for people to understand, mm-hmm. particularly people who don't understand kind of the antebellum army. This may be odd for people today, this idea that this guy's a West Point grad and he's an engineer, what we would now call a civil engineer.
That's right.
So West Point grad Dr. Nance, can you explain how that came to be?
The whole point behind West Point was that the military engineering was seen as a highly technical skill. A lot of the combat arms were expected that you would just kind of feel it out on your own. You either had the skill or you didn't. But military engineering, on the other hand, how to build fortresses, the angles, there's a way to build fortress angles such that there isn't any dead space. Mm. That's what we actually needed to do. And the idea being is that you can then take that skill set and apply it to the building of the nation. And that's actually what you see a lot of the early, because West Point is first and foremost, and still is today in many ways, West Point, I don't know about the most recent graduates, but I actually have a Bachelor of Science in History, which is a little bit odd. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that these graduates are going to go out and basically build the country. Mm-hmm. So all of the civil engineering works, canals, flood control, ports.
Lighthouses.
All of these are part of West Point's legacy to the nation. Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Fry, kind of in this same antebellum world, you touch on something that's really important, and I think military historians know it, but perhaps the more general listener doesn't. We often think of the Mexican War as the school of the future Civil War commanders. So can you talk about that a little bit and explain how that worked?
Well, I think the Mexican War was really the first time that the United States Military Academy and particularly the graduates that came out right before the war were able to prove themselves in the real world and in combat. Whereas, as Dr. Nance mentioned, because so much of the education they received at West Point was really geared toward the sort of internal improvements and engineering products and processes that the young nation required to grow, mm-hmm. The military dimension of that for a long time had been relegated to fighting Native Americans,
right.
An unconventional force in conflicts like the First and Second Seminole Wars that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. But the Mexican-American War is a different experience. It is large-scale combat operations. The regular army is deeply involved in it from the top all the way down. And it's also interesting because this is the first time that some of these West Point grads are experiencing combat under those circumstances alongside citizen soldiers, alongside volunteers and militia drawn straight from places like New York and Ohio and Tennessee, and now being thrown into the fight against the enemy down in Mexico. And that makes for a really interesting dynamic as it unfolds during the Mexican War. Tension between the regulars and the volunteers is very, very high. A lot of these regular army officers, and Meade is just is one of them, are horrified at the lack of discipline that the civilian soldiers, the volunteers and the militia exhibit during the Mexican War. The lack of training in terms of combat readiness, but also the lack of discipline in dealing with the civilian population in Mexico itself. Mm-hmm. And those experiences, and you might even say those prejudices against citizen soldiers, against volunteers, carries over into the American Civil War.
So this is an interesting point, both for the antebellum period and into the war. If you have an army that is essentially a cadre army, right?
Right.
Designed largely to fight internal unrest with the indigenous groups. You mentioned the Seminole Wars. Mm-hmm. Those wars are also fought largely by militia. So is this just a running issue throughout the entire antebellum period?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely something that regular army officers have to be attuned to, just as they have to be attuned to certain political realities of how the promotion system works in the United States Army. Somebody like Meade, it would behoove him to have certain political connections to advance his career. One of the ways I've always tried to be careful about studying Civil War commanders is that some of them are volunteers, some of them are regular army officers, and even the regular army officers are obtaining volunteer commissions as the war goes on, the American Civil War goes on. So in Meade's case, he starts the war as a captain right. in the regular army, but he'll very quickly be promoted to brigadier general of volunteers,
right.
which is a totally different animal.
And we have talked about this with Dr. Nance in the World War II Army, where you have, what is it, the U.S. Army and the Army of the U.S.?
The United States Army and the Army of the United, and the Army of the United States. In the Civil War example, I think one of the most absurd cases I saw was a brand new, newly graduated West Point second lieutenant is offered a colonelcy in one of the state in one of the state volunteer regiments, mm-hmm. which if you can imagine going from, I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express once,
right.
and all of a
right.
sudden you're in charge.
Well,
of
I think the example that most people might be familiar with is George Custer, who, if I remember
right.
correctly, ends the war as a 2-star and then reverts to his permanent rank, which is lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel eventually, yeah.
Which is why he dies commanding a battalion.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got the 7th Cavalry Regiment, but he's in charge of it.
He's a lieutenant
battalion.
Colonel of the 7th
right.
Cavalry, yeah.
So you mentioned something I think may be important for Meade, and this is something I'm used to because I live in a world of patronage.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned he's from an old Philadelphia.
As a French Revolution scholar, yes. we should add. Yes.
and before, certainly. You mentioned that he's from an old Philadelphia family. He goes to good schools. He's wealthy. So what are his connections? What does his family do for him? Does he have a pocket senator in Harrisburg?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand of who Meade's political patrons were, other than to say I know that he made enemies as the sectional crisis deepened. For instance, while he was in Detroit, at the outbreak of the war, commanding this task force, for lack of a better term, that's surveying the Great Lakes, he runs afoul of a very prominent radical Republican senator named Zachariah Chandler, senator from Michigan. There are a vast number of pro-Union rallies that sweep across the northern urban and rural landscape. In the weeks following the firing on Fort Sumter, mm-hmm. This wave of nationalist sentiment explodes throughout the North, and there's a huge pro-Union rally in Detroit. And some of the regular Army officers and enlisted men who are stationed there are eager to join in the festivities and, rally behind the flag and everything, and Meade more or less forbids it. He says that is, that is mass politics run amok. We don't do that. We serve the nation, but we don't get involved in sort of heated domestic political scenes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for Meade, and he's just a classic example of this, and maybe one of the most salient examples, he's having to navigate the fact that he is a regular Army officer in a very unconventional civil-military relations dynamic.
Right.
During the American Civil War, during the sectional crisis, and then the American Civil War. He's known as an enemy of the radical Republicans more than anything else.
Is it fair to characterize him as a Democrat, or is he just a more moderate kind of Republican type?
I have had debates among historians with this for a long time, and the real honest answer is Meade did not self-identify as any sort of partisan identity. We know that in 1860 he voted what was called the Constitutional Union ticket. Mm-hmm. Which was the alternative to both Lincoln, the Republicans, and the Democratic choices, of which there were two in 1860, John Breckinridge and Stephen Douglas.
Yep.
So Lincoln was sort of the moderate choice, or backed the moderate choice, the more forget about the slavery issue altogether, let's just focus on union. That was Meade's proclivity in the 1860 election. I do, however, think that in terms of his policy preferences as the war went on, his temperament, being opposed to mass participatory politics, it's fair to say that Meade probably aligned most closely with the Douglas Democrats, including colleagues of his like George McClellan.
Okay, very interesting. Now, you mentioned as the war is breaking out, you know, he's kind of detached. I don't know if it's fair to say he's on the frontier, but he's not far from
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And walk us through kind of the beginnings of the military part of the war, because that plays an important part in the outbreak. You have this call up by Lincoln for troops.
Mm-hmm.
There's waves of secession. So how does he get from, you know, making maps of coastline through this process to his one-star command?
The Army needs generals, quite frankly, and Meade is just one of many, many West Point graduates in fairly modest rank, many of them first lieutenants and captains who, as you mentioned, are assigned to the periphery or the frontier and are very quickly pulled east to take command of volunteer troops at a fairly high echelon, considering that they had never commanded anything above a company or a battalion of right. infantry.
Wasn't McClellan famously a captain right yeah. at this time frame as well?
Well, McClellan was out of the Army. McClellan had left for a civil engineering job or a railroad engineering job before the war. And so many of these guys are basically begged to come back to Washington to assume command of volunteer troops because they're all the federal government has.
Now, one of the things that's different from a modern military kind of construction process is you mentioned these volunteer troops.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, these are under the command of the federal government, but they're largely being raised by states.
Yeah.
So is it Lincoln, is it the War Department begging them to come back, or is it, in his case, Harrisburg?
Initially, it's the state governors, because to take McClellan as an example, McClellan was sort of the wonder child of the United States Army in the years right before
West Point.
Yeah, absolutely. And so McClellan actually had multiple offers from state governors to assume command of the state militias, which would become the volunteer troops eventually. From those respective states. He had offers from Ohio initially and then Pennsylvania eventually, and he took the Ohio one, McClellan did, before the Pennsylvania one arrived in his inbox. Otherwise, he probably would have taken that one. In Meade's case, and in the case of many others like him, I think it's fair to say all of the above. The state governors are calling for them. The War Department is anxious for them, working closely with the state governments. But you're right. It is the state governments that are commissioning the field grade officers in the volunteer force of the United States Army. For gentlemen like Meade, as soon as they achieve that one-star status, though, they've got to go through Congress. They've got to go through the Senate.
So we're seeing a very scattershot approach here, where there's not a deliberate process of these people show best potential, we're going to put them here. It is, no kidding, across the board.
Yeah.
Anybody with any sort of skill or potential or earmarks or connections is immediately getting pulled into these positions.
It's the inherent chaos that comes with, as you put it, Dr. Abel, the cadre army. Mm-hmm. When a cadre army all of a sudden has to grow exponentially in size through the use of mobilizing tens of thousands of volunteers, that's the chaos that is attendant to that sort of thing.
If listeners are interested, the episode Dr. Nance and I did on the interwar years between the world wars, Dr. Nance is very clear to point out why the U.S. Army spent so much time and effort to make sure this didn't happen when the Army was inevitably formed leading up to World War II.
Because in my era, World War II, is the U.S. Army basically has removed the whole state militia concept. It's got the National Guard. Yeah,
exactly, but exactly.
The states don't do these commissions. It's the government, the federal government that does the commissions.
Yeah, for some reasons we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to divide the war in the way we kind of already have. So we have the war up to Gettysburg mm-hmm. and then the war after Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. So take us through Meade's war up to July of 1863.
Sure. Meade has a pretty good service record up to Gettysburg. I mean, there is a reason why on June 27th, 28th, of 1863, the Lincoln administration decides to tap George Gordon Meade as Army of the Potomac commander. He has shown promise. Mm-hmm. He has shown competence at every level of command with which he has been entrusted, starting, as I mentioned, with the brigade command of a Pennsylvania Reserve brigade, and beginning in earnest, really, during the Peninsula Campaign in early 1862. I mean, Meade is engaged in 1861 in northern Virginia, but once the Army of the Potomac, George McClellan's Army of the Potomac, begins its ponderous operation against Confederate forces down in Tidewater, Virginia, Meade acquits himself very well in command. He will begin that campaign, actually, as part of Irvin McDowell's First Corps, detached at Fredericksburg, but very quickly joins with the Pennsylvania Reserve Division, the main body of the Army of the Potomac, operating against Richmond down on the peninsula. And at the Battle of Glendale, during the 7 days engagements, when Lee counterattacks McClellan's forces after assuming command of the Army of Northern Virginia, in the last week of June, Meade performs very well in that action, but is grievously wounded. He's shot through the arm, he's shot through the back, actually, during the chaos of the battle there at Glendale. And he's out of the fight recuperating for a while. Nonetheless, he comes back and is in command of the division at the Battle of Antietam. Does very well at Antietam, will actually end the action there in command of the First Corps, because Joseph Hooker, his superior, had been painfully wounded in the foot on September 17th. And then Meade will revert to command of the Pennsylvania Reserve Division when John Reynolds takes command of the First Corps during the Fredericksburg Campaign. And the Meade-Reynolds relationship is an important one. Mm. Meade and Reynolds were friendly rivals, is the way I would describe it. They were both competent. They both had good combat records, but Meade's combat record was longer than Reynolds. Reynolds had been captured during the 7 days, whereas Meade had been wounded, so Reynolds was out of the fight as a prisoner of war for quite a while, and then had been detached to command some militia during the Maryland campaign and had missed the Battle of Antietam entirely. So Meade was a little slighted when Reynolds took command of the First Corps, but I think the two were generally on friendly terms, even though they were competing against each other. It was a sort of iron sharpening iron relationship. And so Meade served under Reynolds at Fredericksburg, achieved a significant tactical breakthrough at Fredericksburg, actually one of the only successes the Union Army had. On December 13th, 1862, it was not supported.
Was that on the far left flank?
The far left flank, that's right, against Stonewall Jackson's line at Prospect Hill. And then during the Chancellorsville campaign, Meade finds himself finally in Corps command of the 5th Corps. And he is not, I'll say he's not actively engaged at Chancellorsville, but that's certainly not his fault. He's engaged on May 1st, the first day of action there. But the rest of the battle, The Fifth Corps is not as actively engaged as the rest of the Army, and that's largely because Joseph Hooker simply does not do what Lincoln told him before the campaign to do, put all your troops in.
Yeah, and Hooker has this giant army at San Lucisville.
Oh, it's huge,
He doesn't use a lot of it.
If I remember right, Meade's corps is in the one place where Lee's not really attacking after first day.
Yeah. So Meade has a frustrating Chancellorsville campaign. There's no other way to put it, because he's not as closely engaged as he would have liked. And after the debacle on May 2nd and then the hard fighting on May 3rd, Hooker, who is himself suffering from a wound he received on May 3rd, calls a council of war, which is bringing your corps commanders together, getting their assessment of things, and then hopefully gaining some insight into what the Army's capabilities and condition is like going forward. And Hooker asks his subordinates, what do we do? Do we continue defending? Do we retreat? Do we attack? And
because they've cut the Confederacy up pretty badly by this point.
Lee has suffered grievously at Chancellorsville, there's no doubt about it. Whether or not Hooker knows that is a different matter. Meade is of the opinion that the Army should take the offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And Hooker vetoes that idea and says, not only are we not attacking, we're not defending, we're going back.
Yeah.
Meade is intensely frustrated by his Chancellorsville experience, and I think it's because of experiences like that that Meade has a very jaundiced view of the command culture in the Army of the Potomac and its relationship with Washington.
Very briefly, just so that we can put everyone in another proper time and space, mm-hmm. When is the Battle of Chancellorsville?
Sure, first week of May 1863.
Okay, and that's important because 2 months later,
yep,
we're at Gettysburg.
Yeah, right. and so listeners understand there's a seesaw between essentially Richmond and D.C. or the areas around D.C. throughout most of these years.
Yep.
In this case, we've gone peninsula north, back south, that's Fredericksburg, back north, we've gone back south, now we're about to go north again.
That's right.
Right. So, and this is kind of for both of you, Dr. Nance for the modern perspective, Dr. Fry for the Civil War perspective. One of the things that's striking about this is, you know, we've just run through a Rolodex of commanders. And as we all know, as military historians, time in grade and seniority matter. It seems to matter less here. So first of all, mm-hmm. Dr. Nance, mm-hmm. why does seniority matter in militaries?
The concept of seniority is that experience comes from doing it. And typically, the more senior you are, the longer you've had a chance to just kind of live the life, see the world, understand how things work, understand how the organization's put together. You have, like, take an infantry colonel, a full colonel, 06. That officer, unless something very weird has happened in their career, has led a platoon. Had a specialty platoon, perhaps mortars or scouts or something along those lines, mm-hmm. been a company executive officer, kind of running the logistics and back end of a company, commanded a company, been a battalion staff officer, managing that battalion as a captain. Then, they've been to the captain's career course for education, they've been to the Command General Staff College here at Fort Leavenworth. They then have been a battalion and maybe even brigade or division staff officer for any number of years. They have then gone off and then been selected for lieutenant colonel. They have then commanded that battalion. You get the idea. The idea being is by that time that colonel arrives as wearing the eagle in front of that brigade, he's done it. He's done everything. He understands that organization inside and out, or should. And with age, we hope comes wisdom, and that doesn't always follow, but that's the philosophy.
So there's also kind of a psychological aspect to this as well. If you are sitting on, you know, let's say a battalion command, and some platoon commander gets jumped up to regimental command, what's going on inside your head?
The biggest concern is that lieutenant does not understand how that organization is put together. and doesn't understand all the ins and outs of how this is this organization should be running.
Mm-hmm.
They're very micro in their role, whereas at a brigade, there might come a point where you're going to sacrifice a platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that will, you don't want that to be the case, but the colonel's going to see that larger picture. Mm-hmm. If your view is still very micro, you're still thinking micro, possibly. And that is, of course, a concern. Now, there are exceptions, but it's maturing and growing and expanding mindset over time is the way to really think about that.
Okay, so Dr. Fry, this is the way militaries have worked for a very long time, including the one I studied the century before this. So why is it that this particularly early Civil War federal army is not abiding by the rules of seniority? Why are they just kind of plugging and playing people in these high ranks and saying, hey, let's let Burnside try this campaign?
A lot of it has to do with civil-military relations and how you are demonstrating your competence and kind of speaking up in terms of, well, I don't want to say that. Political loyalty has a lot to do with it, but it's not necessarily the overriding consideration. If it were, McClellan would never have received command of the Army of the Potomac. But there does come a day when his political liabilities are simply too great. Mm-hmm. And so the administration will dispense with him, not in like the French Revolutionary sense, but in the more typical sense. And so
he's not guillotined.
Right. And so there's like, there does come a day when competence is not necessarily more important than political reliability. So it's because of, again, that very curious character of civil military relations in the Civil War, where careers are able to advance in some pretty unprecedented and unpredictable ways. For instance, you'll end up with the phenomenon that Civil War historians love to talk about and debate the merits of, the political general.
Right.
And
so we're thinking here like Braxton Bragg.
Well, Bragg was a regular army officer, but there are certain examples that Meade will run into during his tenure as a Union commander, which...
Dan Sickles.
Yeah, provide no end of grief to him. So that dynamic of we have the regular army and then we have volunteer officers who have political backgrounds is a feature of Civil War and in particular of Union civil-military relations.
So we're talking not people really... who have political patrons. We're talking people who have never been in the Army.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the case of somebody like Nathaniel Banks, had been Speaker of the House right before the war, and then all of a sudden is commanding a corps during, the Union campaigns in 1862.
Not particularly well.
The other thing to remember about this, too, is that one corps in the Army of the Potomac is the size of most field armies of the American Army up until that point in the Mexican War.
Right.
And a single American corps, or a single Union corps, or for that matter, even a Confederate corps, is the size of most of the regular army was prior to the war. So when we get up to these ranks, it's a case of no one knows what they're doing.
Right.
The army hasn't fielded a corps or a...
The scale of operations in the American Civil War dwarfs anything that the United States Regular Army had ever even conceptualized beforehand. The United States Regular Army in 1860 numbered just over 15,000 men. The Union 6th Corps at Gettysburg on July 3rd, 1863 was just north of 15,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the scale of the problem in the Civil War, the mobilization and the command and control problem, is unlike anything these guys have ever experienced or trained for.
So let's round on Gettysburg. The Confederates have won two big victories in the spring of 63. They're marching north. They can't get into D.C. because there's an army in the way. There's defenses. So Lee decides to march north to the questioning of many subsequent historians. And they end up in southern Pennsylvania. I think most of our listeners are vaguely familiar with Gettysburg. How does Meade end up in charge of that army? Is he just next man up?
Yes. I will say he has the good fortune to be next man up, or the ill fortune, depending on one's perspective.
Yeah.
Meade was perhaps not the Lincoln administration's first choice to follow Joseph Hooker, mm-hmm. but they were their he was their final choice.
Right.
There is some evidence that they may have offered command to John Reynolds.
I was about to ask that.
Commanding the First Corps. And I think the evidence is still, it's not ironclad that Reynolds was offered clear command of the Army of the Potomac, or if it was just sort of feeling out Reynolds' sentiments on the subject. But regardless of how far those discussions went, Reynolds did not bite. And a number of Meade's subordinates signaled through various means to the Lincoln administration that they would be amenable to serving under Meade, including at least two of the corps commanders in the Union Army of the Potomac, John Sedgwick and Henry Slocum, both of whom were technically senior to Meade. So Meade commanded the respect among at least most of his peers, most of his colleagues in corps command, that they viewed him as kind of a consensus choice to take command.
Dr. Nance, put us in the mind of these corps commanders. What does it take for you to recommend somebody junior to you for command over you?
It takes some self-awareness, and it takes an intense amount of respect for the person you're talking to or talking about. Because what these guys are basically saying, now some of it could be self-serving because every single Army of the Potomac commander, so up to date, has been relieved in disgrace. So maybe they don't want that. they're quite happy being the aggressive subordinate. So there's right. maybe some self-serving going on. But I think what we're also seeing is these guys, they probably are looking at the command of the Army and they realize this is such a big beast that they don't feel comfortable managing this thing. And they are not they don't want to take that on. And if they're saying this guy can, it could be the give it to Ralphie, he'll try anything. Mm-hmm. Or it could be a case of if there's one person who can do it, I put my money on this guy. Mm-hmm. So there's, it's a gesture of great respect.
Mm-hmm. And we also cannot dismiss the fact that when this decision is made, there is an active campaign underway.
Right.
The Army of the Potomac is desperately chasing and searching for Lee's army in western Maryland and south central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's a good point. The previous commanders largely had been relieved and replaced in times that were not, I mean, they were a crisis, but they weren't a big crisis.
And you're right, this is a crisis.
And yeah, Meade is having to run down Lee. If I remember correctly, there's been a big cavalry raid up north. Mm-hmm. People are mad.
Burned Carlisle.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what does Meade walk into? Does he bring a staff with him? Does he have an mm-hmm. army staff already? And how does he face this challenge that within a week is leading to the most important battle of the war?
See, I would argue Meade actually inherits a very good staff from Joseph Hooker. In fact, I would argue that was Hooker's primary contribution to the Army of the Potomac. Everybody lauds George McClellan for building the Army of the Potomac. Even though he didn't fight with it, he at least built it into what it was. I think, personally, a lot of that credit needs to go to Joseph Hooker, who also did not command it in the field particularly well, but he restructured the staff system of the Army of the Potomac into something far more professional than it had been before.
So we're talking something that may not be a modern staff, but it's more than just, hey guys, come over for a council of war.
Yes, and it's more than just a handful of clerks with no military experience whose primary qualification is good handwriting.
Which historians are eternally grateful for.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. it's definitely the case that when Meade takes command, the staff system is far better than it was when McClellan or Burnside was in command. That's thanks to Joseph Hooker. However, the problem for Meade is that he inherits the system with still Hooker's man, Daniel Butterfield, in control of it as chief of staff of the Army of the Potomac. Meade and Butterfield do not like each other. There are competing factions in the Army of the Potomac that have to be addressed. The first is, and by far the The overriding faction, the dominant faction, is the pro-McClellan faction, the faction that is loyal to McClellan for various reasons that we don't have to get into.
Worth pointing out, McClellan's still around. In fact, will run against Lincoln in the 1864 election.
In uniform, in fact. That is to say, still maintaining his commission. But yes, there's the McClellan faction that's very strong in the Army of the Potomac, and the other faction is the not McClellan faction, the group of officers at usually corps and division command, some of them, who, although outnumbered by the McClellan admirers, nonetheless think that McClellan represents a style of war that is no longer suited to the war aims.
Mm-hmm.
That this war does, in fact, need to eschew all of the conciliatory nonsense and embrace hard war and emancipation as war measures, and therefore, McClellan needs to be left to the dustbin of history, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Meade is a member of the former camp.
Mm-hmm.
Butterfield, his chief of staff, is a member of the latter camp. And so they simply mix like oil and water. Meade, however, makes the determination that since the campaign is underway, since the Army of the Potomac is potentially within days or even hours of locating and coming to blows with Lee's Army of Northern Virginia and South Central Pennsylvania, it is incumbent upon the Army of the Potomac to retain its staff structure and chief of staff. That uprooting everything, instead of just decapitating the command, as Lincoln and Hooker had done with their disagreement, replacing the chief of staff would simply be a bridge too far. And so he retains Butterfield.
So let's talk about Gettysburg.
Yes.
If you believe the movie, the battle was won by Colonel Joshua Chamberlain and by General Winfield Scott Hancock once John Reynolds dies. What is Meade actually doing during this battle?
Meade is managing an exceptional team of subordinates, and that's the compromise response, I think, to what you're alluding to there. He does have a very capable set of subordinates, first and foremost among them, Winfield Scott Hancock, in command of the Second Corps. Hancock is Meade's trusted agent, and the man whom Meade turns to on the afternoon of July 1st, once the advance elements or the advance guards of each army have come into contact at Gettysburg. Hancock is the one Meade sends to Gettysburg to ascertain just how desperate the situation is. So Meade is managing a very competent team. I wouldn't say Meade is calling all the shots at Gettysburg and arriving on the battlefield as a Napoleon.
Right.
I wouldn't say that.
In fairness, we only made one of those.
Exactly.
So it's okay.
But neither is he a passive observer who is simply letting his A-team of subordinates control the entire battle. He is effectively managing them.
So what you're getting at is he's not stepping out of the way because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's
right.
Stepping out of the way because he knows that he has capable people handling the job.
Right.
And he knows enough to get out of their way.
That's right. And I think Hancock is the best example of that. He will eventually, at one point on July 2nd, give the entire Union left wing, I think, to Hancock, which is just in shambles. I'm sure Hancock was thrilled at that assignment. But, you know, basically saying, I need you to fix this. I know you can do it. Go. I've got an army to manage. And
which
it works.
Not unlike Napoleon in many cases when he had trusted subordinates around.
Yep.
He was fine throwing a Davout or a Murat into something and saying, figure it out.
Right.
So very briefly, you mentioned that he was at odds with his chief of staff,
mm-hmm.
which of course would cause tension with the staff. Do we have any indication that that caused problems during the battle, or was he able to work through that and create a smoothly functioning army headquarters?
Well, let me put it this way. The anti-McClellan, anti-Meade faction comes back with a vengeance on July 2nd, 1863. And that is primarily because of, not Butterfield per se, but one of Butterfield's friends in high command, Daniel Sickles, who commands the Union Third Corps. And Sickles, who is one of these political generals, we use that term not necessarily pejoratively, but just as an indicator of a man who did not graduate from West Point and is nonetheless in Corps command. He was a politician before the war. He does not like the position that Meade has assigned him, and he doesn't like the fact that Meade is not babysitting him the way that an Army commander, field Army commander, should perhaps be babysitting a Corps commander who occupies the left flank. And so, on the early afternoon of July 2nd, Sickles will advance most of the men of his 10,000-man Third Corps anywhere from a quarter mile to about three-quarters of a mile in advance of the rest of the Army of the Potomac, occupying high ground, which exposes his men to a crushing assault by Longstreet's First Corps later that afternoon.
So Sickles is the nay of Meade.
The bravest of the brave, but not the smartest.
Always in
the
wrong place.
Yeah. Right.
So the story ends with infamously Lee basically destroying his army, attacking a Union position on the third day. We don't need to relitigate Gettysburg. There's plenty of media out there about it, including a good movie.
We can.
But what's more interesting is what happens afterwards, as we were kind of hinting at the beginning.
Yeah.
So now what we're building to our culminating point. So Meade wins the battle. We often forget to credit him with winning, again, the most important battle of the Civil War. Now the task is to, again, the seesaw is falling back the other direction. We're going to chase the Confederate Army back south. And there's this maneuver campaign as Lee kind of, you know, punches with his left hand while his right hand is broken as he's, you know, skedaddling back to Virginia. So walk us through the second half of Meade's war. The move south, eventually we're going to end up at Richmond Petersburg where we're going to sit for a few months and then to the end of the war.
Thank you for the very Civil War term, skedaddle. Meade follows up the Gettysburg victory with a pursuit of Lee's army back to Virginia that his critics malign for years to come. Well, I mean, what time is it? They're still doing it.
Right.
As dilatory, as half-hearted. And I think it's fair to criticize Meade for certain things during the war. For perhaps being politically tone deaf when it came to civil military relations during a domestic rebellion. But I don't think it's necessarily fair to criticize him too much during the retreat. He did call a council of war when the Union Army had Lee's back to the Potomac River on the night of July 12th, 1863, I think it was. And his subordinates, who respected him a great deal, said Lee's position is simply too strong to attack. And Meade said, all right, in essence, I think you're right. We'll wait a couple days. And of course, in the meantime, Lee did what Lee does. He escapes. So that's very frustrating, and so frustrating, in fact, for Lincoln, that Lincoln famously writes a letter to Meade but never sends, castigating Meade. Well, acknowledging that Meade won a victory and saying, I'm grateful for it, but the war will be continued indefinitely, he says, because of your inaction along the Potomac River.
Well, how badly beaten up is the Army of the Potomac? Because, I mean, they just endured the bloodiest 3 days in American history.
The Army of the Potomac is horribly beat up, just not as beat up as the Army of Northern Virginia. But Meade has lost John Reynolds in Corps command, who's been killed. Winfield Scott Hancock, 2nd Corps commander, has been badly wounded. Sickles has been badly wounded. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing for Meade.
Yeah, it's addition by
but,
subtraction.
You know, a lot. And the Army has suffered perhaps 20 to 25,000 casualties. So the Army of the Potomac is not in great shape as it pursues Lee. That is undeniable.
It's worth pointing out, it's easy for armchair generals to say, oh, you should have pursued. There's a reason pursuit is incredibly rare in military history.
Yeah.
In fact, Napoleon's pursuit after Jena and Auerstedt is one of the very few examples of an operational level pursuit in the entirety of military history, for the exact reason you're saying. An army after battle, even if it wins, is a thing that has been chewed up.
It's nonetheless, though, the expectation, like that Napoleonic model or the 1806, even 1815, to put the shoe on the other foot, model of a decisive victory is what the American public and the Lincoln administration to a certain extent is expecting. And that remains in place even at the outset of Grant's campaign against Lee in 1864.
So you bring us to Grant. Grant is famously the general who will fight, which, you know, is, I think, implicitly a critique of Meade, among other people. So how does this work? When Grant comes down, you know, as you say, people often assume he took command of the army. But what happens there, and how does that lead to the end of the war?
Grant is brought east as overall commander, as general-in-chief of Union forces. He chooses, and I think this is a sign of Grant's political perspicacity, he chooses to make his headquarters with the Army of the Potomac, recognizing that Lee's army is the center of gravity and that the Army of the Potomac needs to be monitored constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Meade could potentially see that as a slight. Meade, in fact, offers to resign when Grant comes east, in essence saying, you deserve to have your own man in operational command of this field army. Grant is so impressed with that he retains Meade in command. And they have a decent working relationship. I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as a close relationship. And it certainly provides a few instances of awkwardness because Grant is looming right over Meade's shoulder throughout 1864 and the first few months of 1865 until the war ends. It's a difficult relationship. And Meade acquits himself as operational commander of the Army of the Potomac, I think, about as well as one could under those circumstances.
So two instances, both of them occur during the Battle of the Wilderness.
Right.
So, which is the first major clash of the Overland Campaign. And the first is the very classic, the staff is worried, and Grant comes in and says, stop worrying about what Lee's going to do, and worry about what we're going to do.
Right.
Shouldn't that have been Meade's responsibility to take care of?
And I think that, well, yes, in essence, yeah. I think that's a good point. There's another instance during the Battle of the Wilderness the day before, on May 5th, when one of Meade's subordinates in command of a division of the 5th Corps came back. He had a notorious temper. Actually, both Meade and this other general did. And this other general, Charles Griffin, just berated headquarters staff in vicious cursing up and down. And Grant, in essence, looked at Meade as soon as Griffin left and said, that guy needs to be relieved. And Meade just said, no, that's just his style. You know, he's let his steam off. He's a good commander, I know. And so the other thing that I think we see with the relationship between Grant and Meade is an increasing amount of frustration on Grant's part with Meade's inability to reshape the organizational culture of the Army of the Potomac to Grant's style. Mm-hmm. His inability to act as the effective manager in Grant's style. At Spotsylvania, the next mile marker on the road to Richmond, for instance, Grant is wanting the Union 5th Corps under Gouverneur Warren to make constant assaults against Confederate positions every single day of that operation. And finally, by the third or fourth time he's asked to do it, Warren just says, no. My men are exhausted. They won't even leave the trenches. They're so tired of this. We can't do it. And Grant, looks at Meade and in essence says, you need to get rid of that guy. And Meade, you know, goes to bat for these subordinates, and that makes for a great deal of tension, I think.
So on that note, with the second day of, the second question coming out of the Wilderness, is there's that famous moment where the Union forces are sitting there going, okay, we fought this battle,
right.
And are we going back home? And instead, it's like a left turn or something like that.
The Brock Road.
And is that a Grant? Is there tension between Grant and Meade onto, wow, this was ugly, but we're going to keep going? Do we know what happened in that conversation there?
I think Meade totally understood what Grant, what Grant's intentions and designs were. I also think that Meade, and this makes Meade sound petty, and I don't think that he necessarily was, although he definitely had an ego and bristled at a lot of the things that were thrown his way. I think Meade may have felt a slight bit vindicated at the difficulty that Grant encountered when he came east.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Grant was used to not easy victories, but victories nonetheless in the Western theater. And as soon as he came east, I mean, there's no way around it. The Wilderness was a defeat for the Army of the Potomac.
Mm-hmm. Or defined Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Right. Yeah. And so I think a little bit of Meade was perhaps, you know, his ego was soothed a little bit to see that victory against Lee was every bit as difficult as Meade knew it to be.
So is it fair to say that in some ways these two men were an effective team, even though they perhaps butted heads, that Meade kind of evened Grant out and introduced him to this theater, and Grant pushed Meade to a place where he may not have gotten himself?
I think that's a fair characterization. Again, I don't think that it was a particularly close working relationship in the sense that we might like. And there was a great deal of tension. And in essence, when Grant came in, I think he took a lot of the pressure off me to communicate up and out. Mm. As general-in-chief, he was basically willing to absorb a lot of the civil-military difficulty that would otherwise have fallen on Meade as field army commander of the Army of the Potomac, and allowed Meade to sort of focus on the down and in, where Meade perhaps thrived
more successfully. A relationship that I'm kind of forcibly reminded of, and I want to see how different it actually is in the in Desert Storm, there is the U.S. Third Army, mm-hmm. which really does have a lot of command and control over the 7th Corps and I want to say the 18th Corps. But really, when we look at that war, we realize that it's Schwarzkopf reaching well past all the echelons and manipulating the corps directly. Is that... And when I think a lot of people look at Grant and the Army of the Potomac, they see Grant reaching past Meade and managing the Army of the Potomac personally, and Meade just kind of sitting off to the side. Is that actually a fair characterization, or are we missing something?
No, I think to a large extent it is. As the campaign went on, certainly by the time the armies get to Petersburg in the second or third week of June, 1864, Grant is increasingly interjecting himself into the tactical level decision making of the Army of the Potomac. Meade's critics would say that that is a reflection of Meade's failures. That may or may not be true. A more charitable way of putting it would simply be that that was evidence of Grant's frustration with the organizational culture of the Army of the Potomac. The extent to which Meade himself was responsible for that, you know, is open to debate, but this is not so much a Meade problem as it is a much bigger problem in the command culture of the Army of the Potomac.
Or you might say it says more about Grant than it does about Meade.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact of the matter is Grant is a very bloody commander. I mean, the Army of the Potomac that arrives at Petersburg in June 1864... it's not the Army of the Potomac that had fought at Gettysburg, that Meade had commanded in July 1863. It just isn't. Its ranks have been devastated by this campaign.
Mm-hmm. So the war ends with a long siege of Petersburg. The next year, Lee finally retreats, and I would say the rest of it is fairly desultory. Give us a very brief rundown of Meade's post-war life.
Well, it's necessarily brief because he died in 1872. Mm. He did not live that long. He remained in the United States Regular Army. He was one of only four or five major generals in the Regular Army at the end of the war. And he was given command of a military district during Reconstruction. He went back home, lived a respectable life as the victor of Gettysburg. And died in 1872. He was unfortunately, and I should mention this at some point here, subject to a congressional investigation at the beginning of 1864. In fact, right before Grant came east, the Joint Congressional Committee on the Conduct of the War, which was headed by radical Republicans, tried to oust Meade and bring back Joseph Hooker. And so Meade, after the war, was still having to kind of deal with the legacy of that. Mm-hmm. Just as he was the victor of Gettysburg on the one hand, he was still, on the other hand, kind of maligned in the eyes of some for his association, whatever it may have been, with George McClellan and the conservative cause during the war.
Yeah, not a good place to be politically, late 1860s, early 1870s. Did he have a chance to write his memoirs?
No, Meade never really wrote memoirs per se. His letters were collected and published after the war, although they were edited to some extent. They can still be found in reprint fashion, I think, and on Google Books and such. His original letters are in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. If you're wanting to see the actual unexpurgated letters,
All their bad handwriting,
to his wife, Margaretta Sargent Meade, back in Philadelphia.
Okay, so now that we've walked through his career, what is the reassessment of Meade? How do you think we should read him?
I think it's important to recognize that Meade was a commander beyond July 3rd, 1863. If we were to devote a longer conversation to Meade, I mean, heck, just this hour that we spent talking about him, a good portion of that is devoted to Gettysburg.
Right.
It sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And that's unfortunate for Meade simply because he does put in a great deal of service to the United States Army and to the country during the 1864 campaign, serving directly under Grant. And in many respects, even though that action at Gettysburg is a sort of command by crisis, the campaign of 1864 exposes the limitations of a man and an army in a much more serious fashion. This phenomenon of continuous operations that Grant inaugurates when he comes east is a real test of Meade and the Army of the Potomac. And it's a fascinating story. And it's a story in which Meade does fairly well, all things considered. Meade is the last commander of the Army of the Potomac, not Ulysses S. Grant.
Yeah.
So neither a superhero, but neither a complete, but neither a total failure. And in point of fact, a fairly better than average general.
And I suppose that could be his epitaph, yes. A sort of better than average general.
Not unlike William Simpson.
Yeah, I like me better than average generals who don't make waves.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Fry, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them. Thank you.